This week on From the Vault, we celebrate the 40th anniversary of 1968. As part of our ongoing preservation and access program, the Pacifica Radio Archives identified some 100 of our most outstanding recordings from 1968. Some of the voices you will immediately recognize, some you won't. Some sound like they are 40 years old. Some sound like they were recorded this morning. They represent how things have changed so much and how we haven't changed much at all. I've also selected some choice music from 1968 to help move the story along, or as Ray Bradbury says,
"You've got to write poetry about it and music about it so that in turn some slow transformation of the political picture can occur."
From the Vault presents the recorded history of 1968 from the Pacifica Radio Archives.
Our government, our president tells us that we are there at the request of the Vietnamese people, that we're fighting for democracy, that we're yearning to make peace, and are so sad that we've gotten no response from the government of North Vietnam and from the National Liberation Front. All of this is completely untrue. The United States was never invited into Vietnam. The United States conceived of this as a power play in 1954 after the French were defeated. And the United States, without invitation, found Diem in the United States and moved him to South Vietnam and installed him as our puppet without ever consulting the people in any way.
Madame Nguyen Thi Binh has no illusions about the future. "Yes," she said as she told me goodbye, "I know when I go home it will get worse." And then, to comfort me, she said, "But do not worry, Madeleine. Our spirit is very strong. Only tell your people to go home."
Since I climbed down this mountain before, things I've seen here make me want to go running home.
Come with me, my friend.
Madame Bean, why does the National Liberation Front ask to be the sole representative of South Vietnam?
Tại sao Mặt trận Dân tộc Giải phóng miền Nam Việt Nam? To answer this question, I shall first deal about how the National Front was born and about its position.
Đều để đứng lên đấu tranh để chống lại.
From 1954, faced to the policy of repression and terrorism by the Saigon administration, backed by the U.S. government, all the peoples of the Vietnamese, of South Vietnamese people, from workers, peasants, to intellectuals, industrialists and traders, to religious people, all have risen up to struggle against them.
Constant artillery, rocket, and mortar fire against the day possibly only hours away when the long-awaited big crunch begins. Constant is probably too strong a term for the present North Vietnamese artillery harassment of the Khe Sanh base. Intermittent would be more accurate, but it is constant in the sense that it's always there. A walk down the road from one bunker to another is as likely to be made with a detour into a trench as not, as a not-so-distant boom warns one of an approaching round, for the crack and zing of a sniper's bullet reminds one that not only is the base in its entirety under direct NVA observation, but every yard of it is in small arms range of North Vietnamese troops who daily draw their ring tighter about it. Such reminders are constant at Khe Sanh, and so for periods of the night is the shelling itself. But probably the most dramatic reminder is the trip in and out. It is a trip many here do not want to make at all. It is a trip very few want to make twice, and it is not one recommended for those who are nervous in airplanes to begin with.
You know, I woke up this morning, people. First thing I did was to look into your eyes. In that space where I used to find so much truthfulness, it was a stone cold pack of lies. You know there's something going on. Something going on, but I don't know what it is. Something going on, people. All right.
This is Steve Bookchester in Washington with another edition of Pacifica's Military Monitor. My guest today, and happy to have him back, is Seymour Hersh, whose new book, My Lai 4, A Report on the Massacre and Its Aftermath, will be published by Random House on May 11th. Si, in your book, you quote a member of Charlie Company named Herbert Carter as saying the people didn't know what they were dying for and the guys didn't know why they were shooting them.
What happened at My Lai, of course, in my personal opinion, was not an isolated incident, and I don't think very many people who seriously study the war would disagree with that. Perhaps we killed 400 or 50 or 500 people there. Perhaps we haven't killed that many in one specific instance before, but it's happened. What we've done with My Lai 4 and what the Army has done, in a way, by charging this Lieutenant Calley, was the fact that this lieutenant was charged that enabled the papers to initially publish the stories that I was writing last year. What we finally, I think, done is surface the, you know, you might say the cancerous fingernail of what's going on in Vietnam, and the whole public can take a look.
Thank you. Expediency asks, the question, is it politic? Vanity asks, the question, is it popular? But conscience asks, the question, is it right? And there comes a time when one must take a position that is neither safe, nor politic, nor popular, but he must do it because conscience tells him it is right. And that is where I stand today, and that is where I hope you will continue to stand so that we can speed up the day when justice will roll down like waters all over the world and righteousness like a mighty stream. And we will speed up the day when men will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks, and nations will not rise up against nations, neither will they study war anymore. And I close by saying, as we sing it in the old Negro spiritual, I ain't gonna study war no more.
Once upon this planet Earth lived a man of humble birth, preaching love and freedom for his fellow man. He was dreaming of the day peace would come to earth to stay, and he spread this message all across the land.
I think women should, you know, can and should sign the complicity statement and make a public thing out of it, you know, make some kind of program out of it. And I think that you can aid and abet by, the other night a guy came up to me at a draft card turn-in and said, would you do me the honor and hand me his card? You know, while I would hold it while he burned it. Well, I was absolutely overjoyed. It was like looking at my first Christmas tree, you know. And the women really, excuse me, David, but hold together the resistance in the back rooms on the typewriters and the stamp licking and all that stuff that goes on. I mean, there's plenty for you to do. Lastly, I would just like to say that I don't think any woman should go to bed with a man who carries a draft card.
I come to New York today with the strong feeling that my dearly beloved husband, who was snatched suddenly from our midst slightly more than 3 weeks ago now, would have wanted me to be present today. Though my heart is heavy with grief from having suffered an irreparable personal loss, my faith in the redemptive will of God is stronger today than ever before. As many of you probably know, my husband had accepted an invitation to speak to you today. And had he been here, I am sure he would have lifted your hearts and spirits to new levels of understanding in his customary fashion. I would like to share with you some notes taken from my husband's pockets upon his death. He carried many scraps of paper upon which he scribbled notes for his many speeches. Among these notes was one set which he never delivered. Perhaps they were his early thoughts for the message he was to give to you today. I am sure he would have developed and delivered them in his usual eloquent and inspired fashion. I simply read them to you as he recorded them. And I quote, Ten Commandments on Vietnam.
Well, the murders never cease. Are they men or are they beasts? What do they ever hope to gain? Will my country stand or fall? Is it too late for us all? And did Martin Luther King just die in vain?
Thou shalt not believe in a military victory. Number two, thou shalt not believe in a political victory. Number three, thou shalt not believe that they, the Vietnamese, love us. Number four, thou shalt not believe that the Saigon government has the support of the people. Number five, thou shalt not believe that the majority of the South Vietnamese look upon the Viet Cong as terrorists. Number six, thou shalt not believe the figures of killed enemies or killed Americans. Number seven, thou shalt not believe that the generals know best. Number eight, thou shalt not believe that the enemy's victory means communism. Number nine, thou shalt not believe that the world supports the United States. Number ten, thou shalt not kill.
He was for equality, for all people, you and me. Full of love and goodwill, hate was not his way. Why was he shot down the other day? Folks, you'd better stop and think and feel again, for we're headed for the brink. What's gonna happen now that the king of
the most controversial film to be made in some years, and oddly enough, an American one, Stanley Kubrick's 2001, A Space Odyssey.
The motion picture 2001, A Space Odyssey, is based on a story by Arthur C. Clarke titled The Sentinel.
Well, for me, the film is a brilliant examination of what will happen when man comes up against a truly superior intelligence.
Brilliantly successful. As a film which creates a world which really doesn't exist and won't exist for another 40 years, I think that it's superlative, that there's been nothing like it ever made.
The HAL-9000 computer, which can reproduce, though some experts still prefer to use the word mimic, most of the activities of the human brain, and with incalculably greater speed and reliability. We next spoke with the HAL-9000 computer, whom we learned one addresses as HAL. Good afternoon, Hal. How's everything going?
Good afternoon, Mr. Aymer. Everything is going extremely well.
This is a pre-recorded briefing in which the security reason of the highest importance has been known on board during the mission only by your HAL-9000 computer. 18 months ago, the first evidence of intelligent life off the Earth was discovered.
Well, it's the first, of course, really major film on science fiction. There have been many science fiction films in the past. Most of them are the low-budget affairs, and very few of them any good indeed, though there have been some, I think, very fine efforts. But this is the first Cinerama movie in this area, and of course the theme of space travel is uniquely suited for the screen. It's a very big budget movie. It cost more than $10 million, partly because of the extraordinary detailed special effects, which are of quite unprecedented. Everybody who's remarked about the movie said some of the effects are unbelievable, and that's why it took more than 4 years to do. Nevertheless, the special effects and the spacecraft, all the different types of space stations and space vehicles, are only the background for the theme of the film, which is man and the universe, or if you like, man and God, and that's the interpretation many people have put on it.
President Johnson raised a question some weeks ago when he was giving his State of the Union address. He talked of all of the beautiful television sets that we have over the nation. In fact, he gave the number, about 70 or 80 million. He talked about the beautiful automobiles and the massive expressways that will hold our automobiles up and keep them flowing. He talked about the number of automobiles, new automobiles, that come out every year. And he said after that, yet that is questioning in the land. That is a strange restlessness. And I guess he raised the question because he didn't quite know what was wrong. Well, there is something radically wrong, and I suspect it is that in all too many instances we have allowed the means by which we live to outdistance the ends for which we live. We have maximized the minimum and minimize the maximum. And so we've ended up with guided missiles and misguided men. And I guess that's the basis of the questioning and the restlessness facing this generation. Our nation is in a mess. The world is in a mess. Now the question is, what do we do? And I must confess that I have no pretense to omniscience. I don't know everything, and the answers are hard to find today because of the great ambiguities of life and history. But we have to do something. Marlon Brando also mentioned the riot report, the Kerner report,
that came out a few days ago. And it said some things to us that we cannot ignore. Some of us have been saying these things all along, but nobody paid much attention to them. Now, maybe after they have now been said by a presidential commission, and now that these things have the halo of respectability about them, maybe some people will listen. But in gloomy and realistic terms, that report pointed out that our nation is moving toward two societies, one white and one black, separate and unequal. And the fact is that with this kind of move taking place, hatreds are deeper, tensions are greater, misunderstanding will be wider. But the commission report didn't stop that. It brought out another thing that is often painful to hear, and yet it must be heard if the problems that we face in our nation are to be solved. And that is the fact that racism is still at the center of our nation. We must honestly face the fact that America is a racist society. And we must see racism for what it is. It is a myth of an inferior people. It is a tragic notion that one group has all of the worth and all of the knowledge, all of the significance, all of the purity, and another group has all of the inferiority, the worthlessness, and the impurity. And whenever racism is a basic philosophy, whether it is expressed overtly or whether it is subconsciously or latently held, it always brings into being an absolute disrespect for human personality. Now, the first thing that must be on the agenda of our nation is to get rid of racism in all of its dimensions. And it means that white America will have to do something positively, affirmatively, and meaningfully in order to bring all of God's children into the mainstream of the life of this nation. It cannot be done short of something massive. And it means that those who have not known the pathology of the ghetto will have to somehow take that empathetic journey and join hands with those who have been denied and who have been hurt and who have been exploited for so many years. Massive programs are needed, and that means billions of dollars. And the question is whether the affluent part of America is willing to make the sacrifice so that everybody will be able to live a creative life.